tuned to Yesterday, presenting programs from the golden age of radio. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. In this hour, continuing series, which will be concluding the stories we've been following. Later on, The Shadow of Fu Manchu and Firefighters. But first, part 7 of 7 of the Mutual Broadcasting System's production of Les Miserables. Orson Welles at the helm in this episode from September 3rd, 1937.
So long as these problems are not solved, so long as ignorance and poverty remain on earth, these words cannot be useless.
These are the words which preface the seventh and final broadcast based on Victor Hugo's great novel, Les Miserables. WOR and the Mutual Network present Orson Welles, distinguished young author, actor, and director, in an adaptation of the book which he has created especially for radio. Each episode portrays some development in the progress of Jean Valjean, a role played by Orson Welles, who is also heard as he reads the narrative passages. Part 7, the final episode of Les Miserables.
In Paris, on the 16th of February, 1833, there was celebrated the marriage of Cosette Fauchelevent to Marius Pontmercy. The date of the wedding was Mardi Gras, and the ceremonies were held in a city gay with flowers and merrymaking. The bride's father, Monsieur Fauchelevent, having suffered a severe accident to his arm, was not present.
Father, how good to see you. We missed you yesterday, but you've really come too early. Cosette is still asleep, but I can tell you the news. You are to come and live with us. It has all been decided. You are part of our happiness, Father. Cosette and I insist you share it with us.
Monsieur.
Is anything wrong? Is your arm still troubling you?
There is nothing wrong with my arm.
Is it wise for you to take the bandage off so soon?
There has never been anything wrong with it. You can see for yourself.
But yesterday you didn't come to our wedding. It was because you hurt your hand.
It was the best that I should be absent from your marriage.
Your pardon, Father, I don't know what you're talking about.
Marius, I'm a convict. I've been in the galleys.
The galleys? You? Cosette's father?
Before God, I am not the father of Cosette. I am a peasant of Faverolles, and my name is not Fauchelevent. It is Jean Valjean. That is true, monsieur.
I believe you.
Cosette is very dear to me, but, well, 10 years, I didn't know Cosette existed 10 years ago. I am, after all, a passerby in her life. And today, our roads separate. She is now Madame Pontmercy. I can do nothing for her. I leave her to your care, monsieur.
But you could have kept your secret. No one would have known.
Perhaps not, monsieur. But I shall always know. You think I might have been happy with you. I... have I the right to be happy? Suppose I remain, Monsieur Fauchelevent. I come to stay with you. We are together. And some fine day, while we're laughing and chatting, you hear a voice shout, Jean Valjean, and the police spring out of the shadow and tear off my mask. What then?
Father. Father, dearest. I've missed you so.
Cosette, we're talking of business.
Father, you're pale. Does your arm hurt you?
It is well.
What is it, then? Are you sad?
No.
Then kiss me. That's better. Now I shall stay.
Cosette, darling, we have something to finish.
You still want me to go? Very well, I shall. But don't be long, please.
Poor Cosette.
You must not tell her about me. I entreat you, monsieur. Cosette doesn't know what this world is. The world of the convict and the galleys. Promise me that she shall never know.
I will keep your secret.
Thank you, monsieur. It is all nearly finished. There is one thing left.
What?
You think, monsieur... you think I should not see Cosette again?
I think it would be for the best.
Yes. Yes. Very well, monsieur. I shall not see her again.
Jean Valjean was a convict. But the bridegroom, Marius, did not know the story of his crimes. There are many crimes, and hunger was one of these in the year of our Lord, 1796.
Jean Valjean, before you are sentenced, have you nothing to say to this court?
I was hungry, that's all, Excellency. My name is Jean Valjean. My sister's hungry, too. She and her little ones. We live at Faverolles, Excellency. I'm a pruner. In the season, I earn 18 sous a day, and that's all. It's very hard, Excellency, and they're all hungry, Excellency. Much more hungry than me.
Prisoner, this court finds, proven finally against you, the crime for which you are on trial, namely the burglary of a loaf of bread.
Excellency, what does that mean?
It means you're a thief. Guilty. 5 years in the galleys.
The galleys. 5 years at the oar of a prison ship. 5 years for his first offense.
Jean Valjean, thief.
Guilty.
Attempted escape.
Guilty.
Prisoner, sentence extended.
3 years. Jean Valjean, thief.
Guilty.
Escape in the second attempt.
Guilty.
Prisoner, sentence extended.
3 years. Jean Valjean, thief.
Guilty.
Escape in the third attempt.
Guilty.
Prisoner, sentence extended.
3 years. Jean Valjean, thief.
Guilty.
Escape in the first, second, and third attempt.
Guilty.
Escape in the fourth attempt and resistance.
Guilty.
Prisoner, sentence extended in the double chain.
5 years.
Jean Valjean, your term has expired. Here is your passport.
Give it to me. I can read. I've learned to read. Let me look at it. The bearer is a liberated convict, having been 19 years in the galleys for stealing a loaf of bread. Original sentence, 5 years. Additional servitude, 14 years. The holder of this passport is a very dangerous man. Excellency, what does that mean?
It means you're free.
What had been the life of this soul? In weariness, in agony, under the whip, under the chain, in the cell, on the convict's bed of plank, under the burning sun of the galleys, Jean Valjean turned to his conscience and reflected. Human society had done him nothing but injury. He had no weapon but his hate. He had resolved to sharpen it in the galleys, and he had taken it with him when he went out. So the passport was right. The yellow passport, which described Jean Valjean as a very dangerous man. It was right that October night in 1815.
Come in. Come in, monsieur. Shut the door.
Listen to me. Listen to me. I'm a convict, you hear that? 4 days ago, they let me out. I've walked all the way from Toulon. I've been 19 years in the galleys. Look, I have money. I'll pay you.
Sit down, monsieur. Make yourself comfortable.
Wait. Did you hear what I said? I said I was a convict. What is this place? It's not an inn. Is this your house?
No. No, this is not my house. It is the house of Christ.
What are you? A priest? Aren't you afraid of me?
No, monsieur. Aren't you afraid of me?
...1815. Another crime of Jean Valjean's, of which Marius knew nothing. A crime committed that October night, 18 years before, in the house of the Bishop of Dives. It was the bishop himself who opened the door that night to the convict, Jean Valjean. He made a place for him at his table and gave him a bed in his best chamber. The first bed Jean Valjean had slept in for 19 years. And Jean Valjean lay in his bed, sleepless,
All through that long October night, he had many thoughts. He thought first of the goodness of the Bishop of Dee, and then thought of his silver. The bishop's silver. 6 silver plates. He had seen them at dinner. 200 francs worth of silver, double his pay for 19 years' labor in the chains. It is true that he stole them. It is true that Jean Valjean stole the plates from the Bishop of Dee. It is true that he sold these plates for 200 francs and that he used this money to make himself rich. Under the name of Madeleine in the district of Montreux, he set up a workshop for the manufacture of synthetic jet. He prospered. He built a great factory. He became mayor of the city. It is true that Jean Valjean did this with the 6 silver plates he stole that night from the Bishop of Dee. It is true also that Jean Valjean was never convicted of this crime.
Yes, monsieur.
We are the police, monseigneur.
Please, officer.
Silence, prisoner. Monseigneur, this man has been apprehended on the highway in the criminal possession of your plate.
Good morning, Valjean.
You recognize him, monseigneur. That is enough. Here is your silver.
Yes, but where are my candlesticks?
Here are the stolen plates, monseigneur. Were there candlesticks also?
Oh, yes. They are of silver like the rest. Valjean, where are my candlesticks?
I didn't take them.
Monsieur Valjean, I don't think you understood. I gave you the candlesticks as well.
What do you mean?
Monseigneur, the prisoner was running off with your plate.
And you? And he told you that they were given him by an old priest with whom he had lodged the night. And you brought him here.
Yes, Monseigneur. Then it's true what he told me?
I have given him the silver.
Then we can let him go?
Of course.
But they aren't mine.
Monsieur, the plates and the candlesticks are yours. Take them. But never forget you have promised me to use this silver to become an honest man.
I have promised you?
Jean Valjean, I have purchased your soul. I withdraw it from the spirit of perversity, and I give it to Almighty God.
Jean Valjean ran out of the city and made haste into the open country. A little gypsy boy passed by him and dropped a penny. Jean Valjean put his foot on the penny and ran after the boy. But he never found him. Another crime. He knew then that he must either conquer or be conquered. It was after this that Jean Valjean, the poor farmer, who became a galley slave, established himself in Montreux as Monsieur Madeleine, the owner of a great factory and a public official. So Jean Valjean was sentenced forever to a new life. And a miracle was worked in his soul by the Bishop of Dee. Marius knew the father of his bride, Monsieur Fauchelevent, and it came to be that he found out the convict, Jean Valjean. But Marius never heard of the wealthy manufacturer, Monsieur Madeleine, the inventor of a process for the manufacture of imitation jet, the public benefactor, the mayor of Montreux, who, like Fauchelevent, was Jean Valjean. In 1823, this Madeleine was a quiet, hopeful man with but two thoughts in his heart: to conceal his name and to sanctify his life, to escape from men and to return to God. But even in 1823, Jean Valjean was wanted by the police. And there came a dark day in that year when they thought they had him. Certainly a man who looked like Jean Valjean was arrested and accused of Jean Valjean's crime, the theft of a penny. And certainly Jean Valjean, known as Madeleine, attended this man's trial.
Monsieur Madeleine.
Your Honor, the judge.
Your note was sent in to me, monsieur. Permit me to say that your presence in this court is an unexpected compliment.
Thank you, sir.
Will you sit here, Monsieur Madeleine? We will resume the trial.
Your Excellency, the judge. Your Honor, Monsieur Madeleine. Gentlemen of the jury.
Who is this man? He is Jean Valjean, accused of one crime for which he is on trial, but he is wanted for another. Highway robbery committed for the gain of one penny from a small boy encountered on the fields outside of D. Convict this Jean Valjean, and he shall be tried again.
What does the man say for himself? May I question him?
Why, if it will interest you, Monsieur Madeleine, certainly.
Thank you. Monsieur Valjean, how long have you been a pruner?
His honor is speaking to you, prisoner. Reply to him.
I don't know, monsieur. My name isn't Valjean. Look here, I'm telling the truth. You've only to ask if it isn't so. Ask how stupid I am. Ask him. I don't know what you want of me.
Officers, enforce order. I am about to pronounce sentence on this man.
One moment. Your Excellency. Your Excellency, may I be permitted a few words on behalf of the accused? I'd like to tell you about Jean Valjean.
Why, certainly, Monsieur Madeleine.
Excellency, they were right when they told you that Jean Valjean was an outlaw. It's true he was a galley slave. It's true he was a criminal. The pennies were stolen, and the loaf of bread, and the bishop was robbed. But mark you, gentlemen, the galleys make the galley slave. This man was a poor peasant, an idiot. He was changed in the galleys. He was stupid. He was made wicked. He was saved later by indulgence and kindness, as he was lost by severity. You won't understand this. There are some things which cannot be told. I cannot relate to you the story of Jean Valjean's life. Someday you will know it. He has done what he could. He has disguised himself under another name. He has desired to enter again amongst honest men. It seems this cannot be. Gentlemen, your prisoner is not he who is on trial before you. Release this man. He is innocent. Gentlemen, I am Jean Valjean.
Jean Valjean, you are charged with concealing your identity and changing your name. How do you plead?
Guilty.
Jean Valjean, you are sentenced to hard labor in the galleys under the double chain for the rest of your life.
But Jean Valjean escaped from the galleys that same year and was never retaken. He was hunted. For 11 years, he lived in the shadows, cowering, sometimes no more than a step from the terrible creature who pursued him, the policeman, Javert. But now Javert was no more. Small comfort now. Cosette was no more. She belonged to another. She whose childhood was passed in his sight like a summer's day. Whose cares were his only care, whose joys were his only joy, who shared with him his only happiness in a long lifetime of misery, who owned his heart and a whole lifetime of love. Her he had given up, totally. He was wealthy, he relinquished wealth. He was free, he relinquished freedom. We have seen Jean Valjean give up the world to save a man from the galleys. The cost was not so great to him as this.
Jean Valjean, I have purchased your soul. I withdraw it from the spirit of perversity, and I give it to Almighty God.
We have seen many things happen to Jean Valjean of which Marius and even Cosette never learned. We have seen crimes which Marius judged without knowing. And more than that, we have beheld the resurrection and transfiguration of a human soul. We know the story without retelling it of Cosette's mother, the unhappy Fantine, and of Jean Valjean's promise to her as she died. We have seen Jean Valjean's Fauchelevent, the father of Cosette. And we have seen him at the barricades, saving Marius from the insurrection, so that Marius could take Cosette from him. We have seen him dragging Marius through the hideous muck of the Paris sewers and into safety. It is only important to remember here that Marius was unconscious, that Marius knew nothing of the manner of his rescue, and never dreamt that Jean Valjean or Monsieur Fauchelevent was his savior. During the months which followed, Jean Valjean came no longer to the house where Marius Pontmercy lived with his wife Cosette in the Rue de Cablère. But shopkeepers in the neighborhood noticed that every day an old man dressed in black came towards that street. When there were but a few houses left between him and this street which appeared to attract him, his pace became so slow that at times it appeared as if he ceased to move. And when he reached the street, he stopped, trembled, put his head with a kind of gloomy timidity beyond the corner of the last house, and looked into the street. There was in that tragic look something which resembled the bewilderment of the impossible and the reflection of a forbidden paradise. He remained thus a few minutes, as if he had been stoned. Later, the old man ceased to go as far as this corner. And then, one day, he did not appear. Jean Valjean was very ill.
Come in.
Father.
Cosette. Cosette. Is it you, Cosette?
Father, where have you been? Why have you left us so long?
Oh. So you're here, Monsieur Marius. Do you forgive me?
Forgive you? He asked me to forgive him after what he has done for me.
Monsieur, I have done nothing for you.
Nothing? You saved my life.
You must be mistaken, monsieur.
I was mistaken, but not now. Perhaps you've forgotten a certain coachman. A coachman who drove you through the streets of Paris one night during the fighting. He has told me everything.
Marius, what do you mean?
But for your father, I wouldn't be alive today. My darling, he was the man. That barricade, the sewer, he went through it for me, for you, Cosette. He bore me through death in every form. Why have you not told it before?
I told the truth.
No, not the whole truth. I owe my life to you.
Father, your hands are colder. Are you suffering?
No. No, little Cosette. I am not suffering. On the contrary, my little one, I'm very well, only...
Only what, Father?
I shall die in a few minutes.
Father!
It is nothing to die. It is frightful not to live.
Father, here, we will help you. Cosette, you must lie down.
Now, children. Children, I want you to listen to me. This money belongs to you. I've written you a letter about it. 600,000 francs. Every penny earned honestly from the jet factory at Montreux. I shall have lost my life if you do not enjoy it. You see, the black jet comes from England, and the white jet comes from Norway. You understand then how much money can be made, and then the class must be bent, not soldered. It's all written out. There. Now come closer. Come closer, both of you. It's in the letter.
Father.
You'll weep for me a little. Not too much. You must amuse yourselves a great deal, my children. 12 dozen cost only 10 francs and sell for 60, and that's really a good business. And you can be rich without concern. You find my letter, Cosette. I've written it all down to you. And, Cosette, I bequeath the 2 candlesticks. There, on the mantel. They are silver, but to me they are gold. They are diamond. They were given me by the good Bishop of D. I wonder, will he be satisfied with me in heaven? I've done what I could.
Father, do you want a priest?
No. No. I have one.
He had fallen backward. The light from those silver candlesticks, the candlesticks of the Bishop of D, fell upon him. His white face looked up toward heaven. He let Cosette and Marius cover his hands with kisses. For Jean Valjean was dead. That night was starless and very dark. It is certain that in that gloom, some mighty angel was standing with outstretched wings, awaiting this soul.
Jean Valjean, I have purchased your soul. I withdraw it from the spirit of perversity, and I give it to Almighty God.
WOR and the Mutual Network have brought you the 7th and final episode of Les Miserables. Orson Welles, distinguished young author, actor, and director, played the role of Jean Valjean and was also heard reading the narrative passages. Assisting Mr. Welles were Frank Reddick as the Bishop, William Johnstone as Marius, Virginia Welles as Cosette, and Ray Collins and Hiram Sherman. WOR and the Mutual Network have taken great pleasure in bringing to its listeners this unusual radio version of one of the world's great stories, the credit for which is due to everyone who participated in the production.
Les Miserables, on Tuned to Yesterday, the last episode in the 7-part series from September 3rd, 1937, on the Mutual Broadcasting System. Though Victor Hugo's immortal tale has lived on through plays and motion pictures, that version, heard on Mutual in 1937, is considered to be the definitive radio adaptation. You're listening to an hour of series on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now a dramatic conclusion and a possible cliffhanger next on The Shadow of Fu Manchu, the 7th episode we've aired chronologically, this number 20, from June 21st, 1939.
The Shadow of Fu Manchu. Based on the stories by Sax Roma. Having located the headquarters of Fu Manchu, through the help of Karame, Nayland Smith, Dr. Petrie, and Inspector Weymouth surround the place with police and enter. They discover Fu Manchu apparently helpless in drugged sleep. In attempting his capture, a trap opens beneath their feet, plunging them into the cellar below. Bound hand and foot, they watch from the protection of a glass chamber as police break into the outer cellar and are strangled by the poisonous vapors from huge fungus-like growths covering floor and ceiling. Smith breaks his bonds and attacks Dr. Fu, but overpowered, Smith is forced from the glass room into the poisonous vapors of the cellar. As he gropes blindly along a dim wall, fighting for breath, a small opening suddenly appears before him.
Mr. Smith, quickly.
Carly, where?
Here, give me your hand.
Oh, thank heaven.
One moment, I must close this panel. Now, quickly, oh, those horrible poisonous things. You must get them off your clothes. Here, let me help you.
That was close. Desperately close, Carmen. I owe you my life. How did you know?
After you fell through the trap, I overheard Dr. Fu Manchu's instructions too loud.
Oh.
I came down here and watched through that small glass panel in the door. I saw everything.
Oh. Those men, the police.
They are beyond help. They died horribly.
Oh.
Oh, but come. We must leave this place at once.
Petrie, Weymouth.
We can do nothing alone. We must get the police. Come, down this passage. Fu Manchu will not put Dr. Petrie and Inspector Weymouth into that cell. Oh.
How do you know that? What will he do with them?
He intends for Dr. Petrie to accompany him to China.
And Weymouth?
He will be forced to disclose the plans of Scotland Yard with regard to Fu Manchu.
But he can't leave here. The place is surrounded by police.
The police. Always you and Dr. Petrie speak of the police. You should know how little Fu Manchu fears them.
Yes, but now, where are we going? I can't leave this house until Petrie is...
Hello.
Listen.
Hurry.
Quickly. We cannot go that way. He is coming.
I'll take my chances with him.
Lal is always with him. Come, we must go back. Hurry.
Can we get out this way?
Yes, by the river. It is the one way for him to escape. One path unknown to the police. Here, into this side tunnel. Quickly, we have no time to lose.
Here's the door.
Yes, that is it. It opens onto an outer stairway. Now, down the stairs, quickly, to that small landing stage. Yes.
We're trapped, Carame. There's no way we can leave this pier.
It is his private landing place. Only those closely connected with him know of it. It is under the old commercial dock. Oh. There, at the end of the stage, his launch. We must hide there.
Right. It'll be the last place he'd expect to find us.
Now, the launch. Quickly. It is our only chance.
By Jove. Concealed completely from the river. Oh, if I'd only thought of this. Here. Hide in this aft cockpit.
Shh. Someone is coming. Now, take this gun.
Quiet. We're safer here than anywhere else. He wouldn't dream of our being on this boat.
So loud. Place the doctor there beside the inspector. Fasten them to that deck rail.
Great Scott, it's Fu Manchu. Weymouth is on this boat. And now, Petrie, where is he taking them, Carame?
There is only one place. His yacht.
Where is it? How can he locate it in this fog?
It lies somewhere at sea, off the mouth of the river. Lal knows and will find it.
I'll take the helm, Lal. Lay your port for the yacht. No light. The fog will cover our retreat, but watch closely for police launches. And now, gentlemen, I shall remove your gag. But first, let me warn you, one cry for help, should we encounter a police launch, will mean worse than death for both of you. I hope you will be discreet. And now, the gag.
Dr. Fu, if it's the last act of my life, I swear to kill you with my own hands. Nayland Smith was my friend.
His death, though a bit premature, was necessary, Dr. Petrie. He has disrupted my plans in England for the present. As for your threat against me, do not attempt it, Dr. Petrie. You will be the loser.
Master, a launch coming to others in the fog.
Shut off your motor. Let it pass.
Won't be something out there. Launch ahoy! You're right.
Great Scott. The police launch, Carame. That's Mackay. I'm going to warn him.
Oh, no. No, not yet. That let them come closer.
Go on running, right, you fool. You want to be run down in this fog?
Away, Lal. Lose them in the fog, quickly.
All harder! Heave to! We're coming aboard to look you over.
Who is running away, Jeremy? Ahoy, Mackay! This way, man! It's Fu Manchu! Come on, Mackay! Run him down! Dr. Fu, order your servant to turn back or I'll drop you where you stand.
Oh, Mr. Nayland Smith. I surely have underestimated your abilities, my friend. But do not be rash. I have in my hands a needle charged with a rare culture. A touch of its point, and Dr. Petrie becomes a raving maniac. Now throw that pistol into the water.
No, I'll kill you first.
Don't do it, dear. Mr. Smith, please. It means Dr. Petrie's life.
Oh, very well. But soon there'll be a reckoning, Fu Manchu. There, it's done.
A wise action, Mr. Smith. And tell me, the party is complete as I at first planned. My child, you were not clever in rescuing Mr. Smith from my cellar. His demise has only been postponed a little.
You can't escape, Fu Manchu. The river's crowded with police launches.
We have escaped, Mr. Smith. Presently, we will be at sea aboard my yacht and on our way to the Orient. That is, Dr. Petrie, Karami, and I. Dr. Petrie shall be my honored guest. Together, we will revolutionize chemistry.
If I live, Fu Manchu, I'll never assist you in your infamous experiments.
And, Mr. Smith, I fear you know more of my plans than is good for you. I must learn if you have a confidant aside from Dr. Petrie. Where your memory fails, and my files and wire jackets prove ineffectual, Inspector Weymouth's recollections may prove more accurate. Lal, more speed. Do you hear me, Lal?
Caravay, my pocket knife, take it. You're closer to Weymouth. Cut his cords, I'll keep his attention from you. You know very well, Fu Manchu, that I have no confidant. Not even Petrie knows my plans.
Perhaps not. Yet we shall make assurance. Doubly sure presently.
Inspector Weymouth is free.
Meanwhile, Karame, come here, my child.
No, I...
Come.
I... Go, Karame. Weymouth and I'll take care of him presently.
What do you wish, Master?
Tell me, Karame, what have you done with Ali?
Ali is where you'll never again lay hands on him, Fu Manchu.
The poison on this needle, Dr. Petrie, works quickly and efficiently. You have appeared to display an undue interest in my Karame. You can never devote your entire mind to those studies which I have planned for you while such distractions exist.
The girl means nothing to me. Leave her alone.
Ah, but you, Dr. Petrie, mean much to her. And she is no longer useful to me since she has decided to work against me. In the East, there is a saying, before casting aside a tool no longer useful, it should be destroyed. Karame, where is Ali?
Wait. Whatever Karame has done, she was forced to do. She's not to blame. Her brother is safe now in the hands of the police.
Well, you'll be Fu Manchu before long.
Watch out for that needle, Weymouth.
Behind you, Nayland. Go in.
Karame, cut Petrie's bonds quickly.
Hurry, Karame. Hurry.
Nice. Inspector Weymouth has it.
Untie the knot. I've got to help Weymouth.
And Nayland Smith.
He can handle the dacoit, even if he has a knife. Hurry, girl.
Oh, but the knots are so tight.
Oh, I showed the strength of that fiend. He's forcing Weymouth toward the rail.
Oh, this rope. Dr. Petrie.
Hurry, Carame, hurry. Ah, good girl. Now my ankles. Quick.
He's dragging Weymouth over the rail.
Hang on, Weymouth. The dacoit, Nayland. Jump overboard when he lost his knife. Grab Weymouth. I'll take Fu Manchu.
Not yet, Nayland Smith. I go, and Inspector Weymouth goes with me.
He's dragged Weymouth over. They've gone. Take the wheel, Petrie. Swing the launch round quickly. Karame, find the light switches. That searchlight on the bow.
We'll never find them in this fog.
The launch has been running wild since the dacoit left the wheel. We must find them. They can't be far. Cut your speed and cruise back and forth. Karame, the light.
But they do not work. Lal must have destroyed them.
Great Scott, no light.
I can't cut the speed. The throttle's jammed fast.
And this blasted fog. Where in heaven's name are we? We can't be at sea. There's no swell.
I'll keep circling around. Perhaps if Weymouth's alive, we'll... Good heavens, that laughter! Fu Manchu!
No, Dr. Petrie. Not Fu Manchu. It is Inspector Weymouth.
The poison needle?
Yes.
Then heaven help poor Weymouth.
The Shadow of Fu Manchu, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 21st of June 1939, a syndicated broadcast. The show heralded for its great adaptations of Sax Rohmer's stories, but also featuring the early radio work of Hanley Stafford, Gail Gordon, and Gerald Moore. We conclude this hour of series on Tuned to Yesterday with episode 7 of about 140 of Firefighters. This heard in syndication on November 22nd, 1949.
Bells, stand by all stations.
Attention, all districts. A 5-alarm fire. 5 bells. Move in immediately.
That's it. Let's roll.
Let's go. Firefighters.
Presenting Firefighters. The true-to-life story of our unsung heroes who stand ready to ride by day or night against our most murderous enemy, the demon of fire. In just a minute, you'll hear the news we've been waiting for, a statement direct from Fire Chief Bob Cody to tell us whether or not Tim Collins, who has recently completed training as a probationary fireman, must give up his lifelong dream of becoming a firefighter, like his father, Ben Collins, who gave his life years ago in the line of duty. Chief Cody is getting out the documents in the case of Tim Collins. Let's go, firefighters! Let's go to the home of Tim Collins, where you remember Chief Bob Cody had just dropped in when fire broke out in the kitchen, and Chief Cody, with Tim at his side, rescued young Trudy and Jimmy from the flames and extinguished the blaze. And then when the excitement had all died down, Chief Cody reminded Tim's mother.
Before the fire, Mrs. Collins, you had a question to ask me.
Yes, I did. And I have.
Oh, Mom, after all the chief has just done for us, don't bother him about my personal affairs.
That will do, Private Collins.
Well, that's it. That's what I want to ask about.
Ma'am?
Tim isn't Private Collins. He's just my Tim. Chief Cody, we've waited all day for the announcement, and it hasn't come.
Announcement? What announcement does your mother mean, Collins?
Oh, you know, Chief Cody, the announcement letter from the fire department.
You know, the letter that says Tim is okay, that they want him in the department.
My goodness, they better say yes, because he has his helmet and boots and his great big rubber coat up in his closet this minute.
Golly, I tried him on. The coat looks like a 10 on me. I bet you if I was...
Trudy, Jimmy.
Yes, Mommy.
Oh, so that's it. Well, now, I'm glad you reminded me of Tim's appointment, Mrs. Collins, because that's the matter I dropped in to speak to you about.
Well, you mean you came yourself instead of the department sending a letter?
He hasn't. My Tim hasn't been rejected.
Mrs. Collins, this is a mighty serious matter. Yes, ma'am, a mighty serious matter.
Oh, good grief. I knew something was wrong.
Trudy Collins, I'll thank you to hand me my coat.
Oh, me, sir?
Yes, you, my young friend. I'll thank you for my coat. Because the documents in the case of your brother, Private Tim Collins, are in the inside breast pocket.
Private Tim Collins, there you said it again.
If I may have the attention of this gathering...
Oh, let's hear it, Mom. And don't look so worried. I don't care. Honestly, if I failed, it doesn't matter.
Now, quiet, please. Tim Collins, by the evidence of these documents in my hand, I find that you have recently completed the training course for probationary firemen. Correct?
Yes, sir. Well, I thought I did pretty well, too.
In this course, Tim Collins, you studied such subjects as the duties of an engine man laying out required lengths of hose, a truck man using ladders of various lengths, including the 85-foot aerial ladder.
Ooh, and the scaling ladder, Chief Cody. Tim can take a scaling ladder and climb up a 7-story building better than any monkey you ever saw.
He cannot.
He can, too. We saw him do it at the training tower.
He cannot. Nobody can climb better than a monkey. But he's just as good, Chief Cody. Honest, he's just as good as any monkey you ever saw. And I bet
you... Oh, stop it, kid.
Yes, be still. Bob Cody, we know all this. We know what Tim learned in training school, and he learned it well. But won't you please come to the point?
That is the point, Mrs. Collins. Your Tim passed his probationary course with the highest rating any man in training has ever achieved. And I came here tonight to tell you so. To say how proud I am that the son of my old friend, Ben Collins, has made good.
But, glory be, I'm so choked up I can hardly talk.
You, Tim, you understand what I've just said?
Well, no, sir. I thought I did all right in training, but... Oh, y'all!
Well, I'll be going now, Mr. Wonderful. Collins. Tim!
Yes, sir?
Private Collins, come out here in the hall. There's one more thing I have to tell you.
Yes, sir. You've got to excuse us, Chief Cody. After waiting all day, the kids and Mom and me,
yes,
too.
Yes, I understand, son, but there's this you ought to know. This high standing of yours, it earns you a special privilege.
Sir?
You now have your appointment as Fireman, 4th Class, Private Collins. And I'm happy to be able to offer you the privilege of choosing your own assignment.
You mean I can say where I want to serve instead of just going where I'm sent?
A post in any firehouse in the city can be made for you, Private. Hook and ladder company, like your father, engine company, salvage squad, anything you decide.
Oh, gee. Well, I'd like to think it over, sir.
Good. That's good judgment, Collins. All right, report to me in the morning at headquarters. And bring your helmet and boots and that rubber coat that looks like a tent when Jimmy tries it on.
Bob Cody, I was afraid you were gone.
I'm just going, ma'am.
No, you're not going at all. We're going to send him to the delicatessen for all the party food he can carry home, and we're going to celebrate his appointment.
Oh, won't you stay, sir?
Oh, the children will be heartbroken if you don't.
And, Mrs. Collins, I'd have felt just as bad as those two kids if you hadn't asked me. All right, come on, Tim, you lazy bones. We'll go down to the store together and bring back a banquet fit for a fireman.
Box 32. Hark and Montague. Not due. We're not due. Oh, you looking for somebody, rookie?
Yeah, looking for Chief Cody's office.
Just got your appointment?
How'd you know?
When a fella shows up at headquarters in a brand new uniform with his boots and rubber coat under one arm and a brand new helmet under the other, we old-timers, we kind of begin to suspect maybe he's a rookie.
I guess I do look pretty green. which way to the chief's office?
Second floor, right up front over the garage here.
Oh, much obliged. Which way to the stairs?
Stairs?
Yeah.
What stairs, rookie?
Well, to Chief Cody's quarters. I said I want...
Stairs? Oh, rookie, you sure are green. There's the pole over there. Let's see you go on up the pole. You're supposed to be a fireman now.
Oh, me? Climb that pole to get to the chief's office? Ha ha. Hey, Private, maybe I'm green, but I'm not that green.
All right, fella, you'll do. You went the stairs, go right through that door.
Oh, tell me, does anybody ever fall for that gag? Try to climb the pole to the second floor?
Oh, boy, you ought to see him. Boots, coat, helmet, and all.
Private Collins reporting for assignment, sir.
At ease, Private Collins.
Yes, sir.
Well, son, have you picked out your assignment?
Yes, sir. I thought it over and talked it over with my mother last night.
Well, you couldn't find a better advisor than your mother, Private Collins.
No, sir, I know that. Chief, I'd like to get all the experience I can. I want to know firefighting as well as any one man can know it, but...
But what?
But last night... Well, I thought it over, and... Chief, I'd like to belong to Old 3-1s. That's where Dad began his career, and that's where I'd like to begin mine.
Old 3-1s, huh?
Yes, sir.
That's a mighty smart outfit, son. Mighty smart.
Oh, I wouldn't expect him to take me on right away, sir, but... Well, I'd like to know I could work toward a post in 3-1's company, sir. And I would work to earn it, Chief. I'd work hard.
I know you would, son. Matter of fact, I had a kind of hunch that's what you might want.
You did, sir? Well, do I stand a chance?
Well, now, Private, I had the lieutenant of your dad's old company on the phone a while back.
Yes, sir.
And he said they need a man in the second platoon. He'd be glad to have Ben Collins' boy.
Yo! Oh, hey, excuse me, sir.
Well, it's yours, boy. Yeah, almost 4 o'clock now, so get along over to 3-1's and report yourself to the 2nd platoon.
Yes, sir, from 4 to 12. Yes, sir, I'll get over there so fast that...
Hold it, Collins, third alarm.
Oh, box 3-2. That's Clark and Montague again, the warehouse district.
That sounds like trouble, Private. Hook and ladder, 3-1's makes the run to Clark and Montague on a third alarm. Now get over there, Collins, as fast as you can move.
Yes, sir.
Report for duty at the scene of the fire.
Hey, stop that car. Pull in here, mister. All right, this is emergency. Fire out of control at Clark and Montague. Get me to the fire as fast as you can.
There he goes. That's Tim Collins, rookie fireman, on his way to his first real fire. And it's an emergency. Fire out of control in the warehouse district, where Tim is to report for duty at the actual scene of the blaze. Fire Chief Cody and the young rookie fireman, Tim Collins, will be back at the same time on the same station when you hear...
That's it. Let's roll!
Firefighters, on Tuned to Yesterday from November 22nd, 1949, a syndicated recording. Wrapping up this run of continuing series on Tuned to Yesterday. We'll be beginning new storylines next week at the very same time. And until our next hour together, I'm Mark LeVonier. Thanks for listening.